On today's episode of The Good Word with Goodwill, what's going on with Monty Williams and the Detroit Pistons? Are the Celtics underrated? And we tell you which NBA games to watch this week. All that and producer John on today's episode of The Good Word.
Good Word with Goodwill on Yahoo Sports, Ball Don't Lie. And here is Vince Goodwill.
Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. We are part of the Ball Don't Lie podcast. Get us wherever you get your podcast. We also really appreciate the feedback that you give us on Twitter and everything else. Don't forget to keep doing that. It is Wednesday, which means it is a solo show with me and producer John. John, who is a big Dallas Mavericks fan, is in mourning right now. John, what stage of grief are you in after last night's Struce Juice from 60 feet?
Is tired a stage of grieving? Like, it's probably acceptance. There's another Mavericks game tonight. I'm ready to focus on that one. We'll talk about that one later towards the end of the podcast. But I don't know. I'm past anger. I'm probably past sadness. I'm probably to the point of moving on, but it took me a while to get here.
If I were still like a fan, I don't know what I would do, to be perfectly honest. If I were out of like this level of basketball space and into the space of living and dying with every game, I'd probably lose my mind. Like, it just takes you, 82 games takes you on this roller coaster. And then the playoffs, it's literally like, I can't even compare it to anything, but the playoffs are such an emotional drain. Like, I'm emotionally drained and I don't root for anybody. I'm just wiped out by the end of the conference finals. I'm generally wiped out. But today, John, we're going to go on a deep dive on the Boston Celtics. And I'm not sure if we are overlooking the Boston Celtics, underrating the Boston Celtics, but I've done a deep dive on some numbers and some theories and some things and trying to figure those things out. But John, of course, has a question to ask me about the team in my region, the Detroit Pistons. So go ahead, John, what you got?
Well, this is tied into a little piece of news, which is that Chris Paul returned to the Golden State Warriors last night.
Yes, he did.
And this coincided with a couple of friends that I have, a couple people that I follow on social media as well, that happen to be Piston fans that are not you, claiming this guy Monty Williams can't coach. And the Pistons gave him a long contract with a lot of money. I hope that's not true. I hope that he can coach. There's some evidence that he can coach. I tried to make that argument and they came back with, nah, Chris Paul was coaching those teams. And like, not all of Monty Williams' success overlaps with when Chris Paul was on his team, but a lot of it does. So I wanted your take as someone who actually probably does watch more Pistons basketball than a normal human being should.
I think the answer can lie somewhere in between. I think Monty is a coach, especially probably at this age, stage of his life, where he needs a locker room advocate, a locker room fire and brimstone type that Chris Paul is. Chris Paul doesn't mind being the bad guy, right? And Monty had some stuff going on with DeAndre Ayton, and I think there's been some regrets there. He openly kind of admitted to it even while everything was going on. There are some things about Monty this year that have concerned me. The treatment of Jaden Ivey or the deployment or lack of deployment of Jaden Ivey. The tethering to Killian Hayes, like, I'll never understand the whole Killian Hayes thing. Even now, James Wiseman, who I understand why the Pistons are playing him, but I don't get why they're playing him. Like, it doesn't make sense. I think just like players can have bad seasons and bounce back, I think coaches can have bad seasons and bounce back. The one thing you can say, even throughout most of that 28-game losing streak or whatever it was, aside from a few games, they were still competitive. They were still at it. They were still going. So they haven't quit on him, right? Even the devastating game against the Knicks, where they were clearly robbed by the league because Dante DiVincenzo hit Asar Thompson in the strike zone in a way that Ray Lewis would have been proud, because he hit him right on the numbers, right? You have a back-to-back from New York to Chicago. Normally, you're dead the next day. You got nothing. That team went out there yesterday and played the best defense that they played all season. That coincides with Isaiah Stewart coming back. And they won a road game, and that is their ninth win of the season. I'm not going to throw roses at anybody's feet. I think it speaks to two things. One, if you got to convince a coach two or three times to take your money, that should be a red flag. That's like asking a woman on a date like six or seven times. If you get no the first time, you normally back off. You normally, not don't get me wrong. I've had my days of persistence, right? I've had my days of persistence. But usually that persistence only lasts for so long before people go back to their first impressions of you. And vice versa. Vice versa, right, John? There's been like, let me talk myself into this thing. And it may go for a minute, and then I'm like, but wait, I initially thought this. I'm not changing my mind. So I wonder if part of this is that. But part of me also wonders if they have said to Monty at this stage, once they realize that this is not a playoff team, which was, you know, fairly early, right? Because they went from 2-1 to 2-1 forever. Hopefully they've told Monty, hey, just get through this season. Get through this year. And we're going to put more veterans around. We're going to put more players that can fit the style that we want to play and the style that you want to coach. So hopefully, and I'm sure Monty, you don't have to give him truth serum. Monty will say, hey, I haven't done a great job with this team. I haven't been able to figure the talent out with this team. So I would say if everybody is jumping on the Chris Paul as coach thing, did Chris Paul lose that 2-0 lead in the NBA Finals to the Milwaukee Bucks? Because if that's the case, we should put him in the same category that we put Doc Rivers in.
It's fair. It's fair. I mean, look, where you take credit, you also take blame.
The Jay and Ivy thing is inexcusable. That's inexcusable. I'm sorry.
That's inexcusable. And then also, like, again, Piston fan friends. So I get kind of in the weeds with them sometimes. And they were all really upset that he wasn't playing Mike Muscala, despite the fact that Mike Muscala was like one of the Pistons' good players. Like, he was playing James Wiseman instead of Mike Muscala. Mm-hmm. And I believe Mike Muscala was bought out.
He just got a buyout so he can go play with a contender, which is probably why he wasn't playing Mike Muscala.
Yeah. Yeah, because they're not trying to win. Although Monty said they're trying to win.
Yeah, that was a weird thing. Like, the things, that's the confusing thing for some people, that he'll come out and say in the first practice after the All-Star break, hey, no more experimenting, no more just throwing lineups out there. We're trying to win games in this last whatever of the regular season. And then he throws out the all bench lineups. And then he throws out, you know, he playing 12 guys. That's inconceivable in today's NBA. Tom Thibodeau doesn't realize that the Knicks have 12 players on the damn roster. All right. He's playing three. All right.
Wait, yeah, I have a question, though, about this whole Monty Pistons situation.
Okay.
And it's going to piggyback on what happened with the Bucks like a month ago.
Okay.
So the Bucks hire Adrian Griffin, but they're keeping Doc Rivers around. Not keeping, they're bringing in Doc Rivers to be like an advisor, right?
Yes.
He's advisor to the team. He's helping Adrian Griffin, all that stuff. We saw how that worked out. The first sign that like, oh, Adrian Griffin's not it, they bring in Doc. The Pistons had a very good head coach, a guy who won Coach of the Year not that long ago. And they were like, Dwayne Casey, we're pushing you to the side. You're an advisor or whatever, part of the front office now. And we're bringing in Monty Williams. I don't think that that is a great formula for success. Granted, Monty's going to get his bag either way.
Right.
But now you have the old head coach who and the new head coach, and they're both in the building at the same time. You know how coaches work. They're not going to be aligned on absolutely everything.
I will say this. Dwayne's been on the road a lot. Dwayne goes on the road and does a lot of scouting. And what part of that comes down to is when they brought Troy Weaver in, Dwayne Casey was the incumbent. And usually you bring a GM in, you allow him some level of autonomy to keep the head coach. And not to say that he probably didn't have the option to move on from Casey if he wanted to. But with where we were as far as the pandemic, where the team was as far as going to go from a transition to, remember they had Blake Griffin on that roster and Derrick Rose on the roster and all those other guys. They had to shed a lot of some of that old long money to get to a point where they had, you know, flexibility. And then you go into the coaching search, where even the coaching search was raggedy, you know, by and large. There was Charles Lee and what's the coach in Brooklyn? Kevin Ollie and Jaren Collins. And then Monty Williams appears and they're like, hey, Tom Gores wants him. Arne Tellem wants him. Let's throw him the bag. And all the circumstances surrounding Monty Williams that he sort of laid out, his wife, his second wife now or before during the summer, having breast cancer. And I think it was breast cancer. And now that, you know, some of that was cleared up and everything else, like he felt better to coach. But it goes back to knowing where you have to have a lot of awareness. I think this is how I can sum this all up. You have to know where you are as a franchise. You literally, whether it's Dwayne Casey or anybody else as a coach, you have to know where you are as a franchise. You have to know if you're ready to run or if you're ready to jog. And this team was still in a very walking stage, a crawling stage. They're not ready to run yet. They're not ready to jog yet. They are still figuring out a lot of things about who they are, who they should be. They just had to outright release the number 7 pick in the 2020 draft, Killian Hayes. Because the kid can't play. Not at this level, not right now. And yet and still, he was being given an inordinate amount of opportunities, especially over a guy like Jaden Ivey. I will say this about Ivey. Ivy's competing now, and Ivey has a certain level of resilience that he wasn't letting this situation beat him down. And now you're moving forward with, okay, let's see what happens with Cade Cunningham, who's balling now. Cade Cunningham has been balling since the All-Star break. And you're trying to figure out where does Cade and Ivey fit together and all that stuff. So, yeah, it's a lot going on. Maybe we'll do a deeper dive over the summer because people ain't coming here to listen to no damn Detroit Pistons podcast, okay? All right? Now to the lecture at hand. The Boston Celtics, John. And I'm gonna give you guys a peek behind the curtain. This was a John Gennaro idea for today's podcast. Give producer John all of the credit. The Boston Celtics are so good, but yet so much of an afterthought. I hadn't even thought of them myself. And this was after we did Monday's podcast. If you didn't hear it, go back. Monday, we had Sam Amick on. We went through the Western Conference. We focused a lot on a few teams, but we did a lot of Western Conference talk. And then John came with the idea, hey, we should talk Eastern Conference and let's go and do a deep dive on this team that's really, really good, but we got trust issues with, right? You know what comes up for me, John?
What's that?
You're going to laugh because you seem like the type that watched Chappelle's show back in the day before Dave Chappelle lost his mind and we like can't refer to him and everything else. So there was the jury duty skit for Dave Chappelle where he was auditioning, where he's being interviewed to do all these different jury trials. And one of them was the O.J. Simpson trial, as if he would have been a juror for that. And he says, reasonable doubt, I got questions. And then he went through all the lists of things about, you know, black people and evidence and da 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 da. He's like, how can Biggie and Tupac get shot and the Nicole Simpson's killer gets found the next day? He's like, Nicole Simpson can't rap. I want justice. But the larger point is reasonable doubt. Do we have reasonable doubt with the Boston Celtics? They have all these things working in their favor. If I didn't tell you that this was the Boston Celtics I was talking about, if I didn't tell you this team was on a 65-win pace, if I didn't tell you that this team was on a 9-game winning streak where they are the number one offense overall, the number three defense overall, multiple all-stars, an X-factor that has all-star potential, a defensive player of the year candidate. They have all the championship ingredients, plus they have the championship heartbreak. Plus they have, man, we blew it in the NBA Finals against Golden State. They were up 2-1. They were bigger, faster, stronger, and then Stephen Curry came and took their heart. We saw it. We seen it. I was there. I saw it. Steph Curry in game 4, NBA Finals. Took it from him. One of the most impressive things I've ever seen. And Boston collapsed. And then last year, conference finals, they collapse again. They go down 3-0 to the Heat. They resiliently come back. Remember that game 6, the Derrick White tip-in at the buzzer, which would have ended the conference finals in Miami and got us sent to South Beach just a little bit earlier, you know. But, you know, I'm not complaining, John. Not complaining at all. I got to spend a couple days in South Beach. I'd rather be in South Beach in June than Boston. No disrespect to my Boston people. All right? No disrespect to the Boston listeners on this podcast. It's just, it's a June thing. I'm sure even people in Boston would much rather spend June in Miami than June in Boston. All right, cool. But, John, getting back to these Celtics, and you pointed this out to me. You said that this team, by net rating, is one of the top 10 best teams in NBA history. And some people will go deep into the weeds and like, what's net rating? Net rating is pretty much your offensive rating per 100 possessions, your defensive rating per 100 possessions, and what the difference is betwixt the two. Okay? So if you don't believe that this is a championship indicator, if I just told you the names of these teams in these particular seasons, these are the top teams in net rating, it would give you some level of indication. Number one, the 96 Bulls. Number two, the 97 Bulls. Number three, arguably the greatest team we've ever seen, no disrespect to the Bulls, in the 2016-17 Golden State Warriors. That is the first year of Kevin Durant. That's when they just, that was better than the 2015-16 Warriors. That was just a nuclear weapon that had no chance of anything, right? Right? Next team on the list, the 15-16 San Antonio Spurs. Back end of Duncan. I think that was Duncan's last year, but that was Kawhi. That was a sports car. It was that team. They won 60-something games. Next up, the 2007-08 Boston Celtics. Garnett, Pierce, Allen, that guy Doc Rivers that we're not sure can coach, that team. Next thing on the list, the 92 Bulls, which might be the best Bulls iteration of the Chicago Bulls, right? So you go down a couple more teams, and then boom, the 2023-24 Boston Celtics. Now, John, I'm not a complete devotee to net rating in the way because some of these teams, I can easily explain why there is such a discrepancy in how well they played. Taking nothing away from the 96 Bulls or the 97 Bulls, but that was in the age of expansion. That was in the age where the talent didn't catch up to the teams, and the Bulls were also that much better. The league went from 23 teams to 30 teams in a span of like 6 years. That is insane. So what's going to happen is you're going to have a few good teams that have the infrastructure and have the great players, and then you're going to have some real bum-ass teams, some real rat-ass teams out there that you're going to feast on. Keep in mind, the 96 Bulls lost to the expansion Toronto Raptors of Damon Stoudemire in 96. Right? Just keep that in mind. Keep all that in mind. Still a great team, but I'm saying from the standpoint of net rating of what your offense looks like versus your defense. I'm not taking anything away from the greatness and the championship worthiness of it. I'm just saying over the course of 82 games, some of these numbers can be more easily explained. But all of those teams that I named to you, with the exception of that Spurs team, with the exception of the 2015-16 Warriors team, which won 73 games but lost in the finals to LeBron James and the Cavs, that's the team that's right before the Celtics on this list. But that just shows you the company that they're in. Their offense, when they're hitting shots, is unstoppable. Their defense always seems to travel. They have some of the most versatile defenders in the league. Their top six is arguably, and say arguably, John, their top six is the best in the league, period. Easily. That includes Denver, right?
Easily, yeah.
Everybody can shoot. They're top eight. When you go from the starting five and you go from Horford to Porzingis, you know, the Jasons, and then you go to Sam Hauser and Peyton Pritchard, who are getting 20 minutes a game. That's a bit concerning for me, John. I'm not sure how good those guys are, right? You find that out in the playoffs. We had a feature done on Kristaps Porzingis by Dan Devine that came out yesterday. Go check that out on Yahoo Sports, where he goes deep into the numbers on KP. And KP is the guy that unlocks all this because he, at this point in his career, can post up smaller guards. He can punish those switches. He helps out so much defensively, covers so much ground. He's so smart. He's so astute. All that stuff. But why do we have trust issues with the Boston Celtics, John? Do you have a theory on why we have trust issues with the Boston Celtics? Or do you think we're just trying to find ways to talk ourselves into other things in this season?
Well, let me say one quick thing on the net rating thing you were talking about. So when you look at the top 10 teams net rating historically, this year's Celtics team is number 10.
Yep.
A lot of the other teams are dynasties, right? There's three from the Jordan Bulls.
Yes.
There is 1, 2, 3 from the Steph Curry Warriors. There is the tail end of the Duncan Spurs when they added Kawhi and got a little bit younger and a little bit better. There's that Celtics team, which, you know, they didn't really have a chance to be a dynasty because they all got together when they were pretty old, right? There's right. The Bucks team before the merger when they had Kareem.
Yeah.
And then he immediately goes over to the Lakers, right? And I think the following year's Lakers are also in the top 10 because that's how good Kareem was. These are dynastic teams. And the Celtics are actually young enough that if, let's say the Celtics win the title this year. Now, there's some questions and we'll get to them in a second. But let's say the Celtics win the title this year.
Mm-hmm.
Jaylen Brown's still pretty young. Mm-hmm. Jason Tatum's still pretty young. Kristaps Porzingis is only 28 years old. Derek White's still pretty young. Like, outside of Horford, that top six is still pretty young. They could turn into kind of a dynasty real quick if they can just be this good all the time, forever. The reason that I think I am not just looking at them like we did the KD Warriors, when it's like no one's gonna beat them, you know, we went into that those seasons with the KD Warriors going, I mean, either LeBron's gonna stop them or no one will, and we should be doing that with the Celtics, but we're not. And I think it's a twofold reason. One, the difference between this year's Celtics team and last year's Celtics team is really Kristaps Porzingis.
Yes, absolutely.
And that Dan kind of made that point in his article, too. And Porzingis is the key that brings it all together.
Yes.
And Porzingis even, he's quoted in the article in an interview he gave to Jake Fisher at some point, saying he understands that the question about him at this point in his career is not can he do it? It's can he stay healthy?
Yes.
Because if Porzingis goes down, let's say Porzingis tears an Achilles, an ACL, something. Like, I'm a Mavericks fan. I lived through the Porzingis Mavericks era. And yeah. The main reason the Mavericks traded Porzingis away was they were like, if he has another knee injury, we're screwed. This completely screws our ability to contend. I think if Porzingis has another major injury, it screws up this Celtics thing in a major way.
For sure.
They traded Marcus Smart kind of to get Kristaps Porzingis. Like, if Porzingis is not there in the playoff run, it's going to be harder for them to do a better job than they did last year or the year before against the Warriors, against the Heat, like you were talking about. I think that and that alone is the reason that I can't really view them as an unstoppable juggernaut.
Well, I think it's even more simpler than that, because I don't think that people come down to the minutia of Porzingis. I think it starts higher than that. For one, a lot of people have been trying to talk themselves into Jason Tatum as MVP candidate because he's best player on best team. And I'm urging us, let's think a little harder. Y'all, it ain't got to be that damn simple. Like, we can do something besides looking at the standings and saying, oh, who's the best player on that team? He's the MVP. We can do something a little bit better than that. I'm not saying Jason Tatum isn't a superstar. I'm saying when you compare him to Nikola Jokic and what Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is doing and Giannis, who's there, and Lucas, who's there, you can see there's a difference. And here's the other thing. I think this is the greater part of this, to me, as far as our modern-day trust issues for the Celtics. Is because we've seen them around for so long and they haven't gotten over the hump. Like, if you think about it, Jason Tatum arrived in 2017. The year before that, they made the conference finals against LeBron in the 2016-17 playoffs, and they had no chance. And then you draft Jason Tatum, I think it was third, by virtue of the trade with the Philadelphia 76ers when they got the pick by the whole Garnett-Pierce thing. That's going way in the Wayback Machine. But think about this. 2018, Game 7 Eastern Conference Finals. 2019, that was the second Kyrie year. They were in flames in the second round, but still advanced. 2020, in the bubble, Conference Finals lost to Miami. 21, they got waxed by that monster in Brooklyn when Brooklyn looked like they were putting it together, right? But that was the inflection point. You had Kemba on that team. You had Tristan Thompson on that team. Jabari Parker on that team. Those guys were getting major minutes. Boom. Completely different team the next year. But the Boston Celtics were still there. Ime Udoka takes over. They go to the finals. Then last year, Ime Udoka, the same. You know, y'all know what happened with him. Being a little tricky out here. Okay? Then they go to the conference finals. So what I'm saying is, we have felt like we've seen the Jason Tatum Boston Celtics at the doorstep for a number of years. Quietly, y'all, this is kind of old school NBA. Quietly, y'all, you watch a team fail and fail and fail, and then boom, they get there. But I think because we haven't seen them do it, we have trust issues on why would they do it this year when they didn't do it last year, when it seemed like the road was an easier road for them to get to the finals last year than this year. It feels like it. It feels like it was, especially with Milwaukee getting popped in the first round, especially with you going against the eighth seeded Miami Heat in the Eastern Conference Finals, and they wet the bed. But with that said, John, it's becoming harder to deny. Here's what I think of the Celtics. This is the best analogy I have. John, I had a friend of mine, and I've used this friend before, but I don't think you could be able to correlate. Maybe you could. I haven't named him because I'm afraid if he'll find me. But you ever have a friend that like is your first friend with a really nice car at a young age, and he probably has no business having a nice car? My friend had a Cadillac when we were in high school. He had a Cadillac Catera. Okay, I didn't have a car. But he was the one that always wanted to drive. Wanted to drive to the mall, wanted to drive to the other side of town, whatever it was, right? And he loved driving recklessly. Like, to some degree, I don't know why I'm still alive, considering I was in this car with this man, all right? And he would have this button. I have no clue what this button did. He called it, it was an S button. It said S on it. I don't know if that meant sport. I don't know if that meant super speed, whatever the hell it meant, right? But he would press the S button on the freeway. Mind you, this is in Detroit, y'all, where we got a lot of cars and a lot of traffic. He pressed the S button, and that thing would go from like 65 to 100 miles an hour on the Southfield Freeway. It felt like Men in Black in a tunnel, where we were just riding above everybody, right? That's what it felt like. I should not be alive today. Like, I did have on a seatbelt, John. I did have on a seatbelt. But man, that kid drove crazy. Had no business driving the car. I say that to say the Boston Celtics are like that car that's in traffic with you at like 65. They're going at a nice pace. And they didn't look around. And they're like, why are we going 65 with the rest of these peasants? Let's hit 100 and let's go run and hide. That's what they do. They did that last night. Oh, what? This team is hanging with us? Let's go on this 20-0 run where we blitz you from three, where we get every single stop, where we protect the rim. They protect the rim at one of the most underrated rates of any team in the league. It's not just the shot blocking. It's Jason Tatum is a rim protector. Jaylen Brown, they're both tall. They're both long. They can cover a lot of space. They help our own defense. They get there. We all know about Derek White from the guard position. He's a really good help defender. We know Jrue Holiday, who I had not mentioned yet in this podcast. We'll be 30 damn minutes in. Jrue Holiday, another great defender. All of those things as they add up. I don't think steals necessarily translate in the playoffs, but I do think shot blocking does. And getting that extra block, that extra rim protection, saves you some possessions. John, they're holding teams to 43% shooting during this 9-game winning streak. They're outscoring teams by 16 points a night. They're running and hiding. And I know people think, John, that the regular season doesn't matter, that it's too damn long, that it's, everybody talks about it. Why are you asking guys to play 65 games and we should shorten the season to 72? And, you know, this is why the NFL is king, because they have a shorter season. Robble, robble, robble. Y'all, I need y'all to have a little bit of common sense here. Just a little bit. Just work with me. Because I think that there is a great value in 82-game regular season, both from what the Celtics are doing, but just as a whole. In 82 games, you go through a lot of ebbs and flows. You figure out what works and what doesn't. You figure out who you are team-wise, because once the playoffs start, all it is reinforcing whatever those habits are. You learn those habits. And John, I'm going to go deep into the history weeds. I have a theory. I think every championship team, no matter who you are, you have to have a 6 to 8 week stretch where you take everything so damn seriously that you literally blow every team away for a 6 to 8 week stretch that it says I'm a championship team. Why do I say 6 to 8 weeks? Because that's how long the playoffs are. That's how long you have to sustain your concentration from a night-to-night basis to say, this is how serious we are taking it. The regular season is a slog. It is a battle of attrition. It is all of those things. But every championship team, the great championship teams that I've seen in my life, I can point through periods where, I don't care if it was the start of the season, where they take it seriously for 6 to 8 weeks and run away and hide, or even towards the end of the season, after the trade deadline, whatever it is, you have to give me 6 to 8 straight weeks of balls to the wall basketball where teams literally walk into your building and they know they have no chance, or you walk in theirs, into theirs, and they realize they have no chance. So John, so think about this exercise, John. I'm going to ask you this question. Cause maybe we're fooling ourselves into thinking that there's a bunch of teams that have reasons to say that they can win the championship this year. John, in the past 20 years, how many teams outside of the top 3 seeds on either side of the conference do you believe that has advanced to the NBA Finals or won an NBA championship?
Top 20 years?
20 years, since 2003.
Dang.
Last year with the Miami Heat, in 2010 with the Boston Celtics, the older Boston Celtics. That was Kevin Garnett post-knee injury. They were the 4 seed. And remember, they beat LeBron and the Cavs in the second round where LeBron took the jersey off at the Boston Garden. And, you know, is this the last time LeBron James is going to wear a Cleveland Cavaliers uniform? Yeah, kind of. You know, that sort of thing. So basically what I'm saying is you have to be a top 3 seed. And there's going to be some people who look in the standings and say, wait a minute, the Dallas Mavericks won 60 games, were a 4 seed. Yeah, because the way the divisions were set up and everything else, but they had a top 3 record the year that they went to the NBA Finals. I think in 2006, Dallas won 60 games. They were a 4 seed technically, but they had a better record than the 2 and 3. You get what I'm saying? Only the 8th seed at Miami Heat that had to go through the play-in in the 2010 Celtics. So basically what I'm telling you today is that by and large, that you got Boston, maybe Cleveland, maybe Milwaukee. Those are the top 3 seeds in the East, as evidenced by John's misery over there, the Cleveland Cavaliers, who he's seen up close and personal, a bit hot. And in the West, you got Minnesota, OKC, and Denver. If history is our guide, that's all I'm saying. If history is our guide, that's what I'm saying. Not Phoenix, not the Lakers, not Golden State, those 3 teams. So here's the other thing. When I say the 6 to 8 weeks, John, like even Denver last year, they had a 32-9 stretch. They went from 14-10 in December 8th to 46-19 on March 6th. That's a 3-month stretch where they just said, all right, cool, we are taking all of this seriously, right? And we had doubts about the Denver Nuggets too, of people. It's a lot easier to say now that we've seen the results that, of course, Denver should have won it last year, but we had doubts about them. Jamal Murray, Michael Porter Jr. Can Jokic carry a championship team? Is Michael Malone a championship coach? Do they have the bodies? Remember, we were saying that. We fixed our mouths to say that. But it's a lot easier to start from the end and get to the beginning and say, of course it makes sense. They hit this 32-9 stretch, right? Golden State the year before. They started off 18-2. They were 24-5, I think a little bit after Christmas. They sputtered. They had some crazy, crazy sputters after that. But they started off hot. And to me, that was the proof of concept, as Dan Devine would say. That's the six-week stretch where you would say, okay, you guys are taking this really, really seriously. Toronto in 2019, because I can't. The 2020 and 21 seasons, because they weren't full seasons, because everything was so compressed, or 2020 because it was so odd. It's hard to do. But 2019, the Kawhi Leonard Toronto Raptors, where he basically played half the damn games, you know what they did? They went from 28-12 to 44-16. That's a 16-4 stretch. That's 20 games where they said, we are taking this more serious than anybody else. Let's go further back, John. The 2016 Cleveland Cavaliers, a team that we said, by and large, kind of underachieved on a regular season, right? They fired their coach David Blatt, the guy who says, I performed in front of many presidents. That was the funniest statement, John, I've ever heard in my life. We were in Chicago, and they said, President Obama is coming to the game tonight. Obama's a Bulls fan. The game was in Chicago. David Blatt said, you know, I've been in front of many presidents before. Ain't nobody asked you about what you did in front of other presidents, fool. We said Obama's coming to Chicago to watch the Bulls and the Cavs, and you fixed your mouth to say that. All that aside, right? They went from 13-7 to 35-12, 23-5 stretch. Taking things seriously. Let's go further back. I only got two more examples for you, but you get what I'm saying. The 2000 Lakers, one of the greatest teams we've ever seen. They started off 23-24. Or they started off, they had a 23-24 stretch. And then another stretch where they won 19 straight games. And this was with Kobe Bryant not being the full version of Kobe Bryant. They took it seriously. The 91 Bulls, they went from 20-10 to 50-15. That's the first iteration of the Jordan Championship Bulls. And that's a team that was not on that best damn rating list, John Gennaro.
You know who else wasn't? I noticed it earlier and you just mentioned it. I mean, you and I, we are of a similar age and we grew up with Jordan's Bulls dominating. But when we got to a certain point, we're 18, 19, 20, 21 years old. The Lakers were the dynasty.
Yes.
The Lakers were the dominant team.
Yes.
I've heard you say that you believe the best big man in the history of the NBA was Shaq around that time.
Yes.
None of those Lakers teams had a better net rating, were even in the top 10 of net ratings that we were talking about at the beginning of this, which goes to show you just how great this Celtics team is this year.
Or it shows you just maybe this statement is not a hard and fast rule, John, if we're not having those Lakers teams on there. If this Lakers team won 23-24 in one stretch, 19 straight down another stretch, and they're not on this list, the list is flawed, right? I just told you about the 91 Bulls, 30-5, the scariest team of my lifetime because I was a Detroit Pistons fan, and that's Michael Jordan at his most determined. That's the Michael Jordan that put on the muscle. That's the triangle offense. That's all that stuff. They went 30-5. And then the teams that I grew up loving, the 90 Pistons won 25 of 26 games, John, during the stretch. They just said, you know, we're just tired of this. We're going to push the S button. We push the S button and we're going 100 miles an hour. The year before that, they went 30-4 after acquiring Mark Aguirre. Like, this is what happens. Championship teams have that stretch. The Celtics have taken, by and large, the entire season seriously. When you're on a 65-win pace, I doubt that they get to 65 because I'm betting once you clinch the East, you start throttling it back, you rest some guys to make sure, especially if you're only playing eight guys, you throttle it back a little bit, you make sure that Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown are completely healthy going into the playoffs. But they have everything, John. They do. And I have my concerns about the shot selection sometimes in games that they lose. And granted, it's a small sample size of games that they've lost this year, right? They've only lost 12. And when they lose, they shoot 31% from three. And they take the same amount of threes and losses that they do in wins, which to me points at a lack of shot recognition that we don't have it going tonight. And they don't explore other ways to score. But I understand why you wouldn't do that, because inevitably the shot turns around, because the shot always turns around, because the evidence says we're going to wind up shooting 40% by the end of the night. And Joe Mazzulla, who's done a really good job this year of embracing what this team is, like, he's not backing off of that. I give him credit for that. John, my only doubt or fear for the Celtics is A, an injury, B, not having a counterpunch in the playoffs, because in the playoffs, you got to have a counterpunch. In the playoffs, after game three of a playoff series, everybody knows what everybody's running. What can you do outside of the game plan? What can you execute outside of the game plan? At the game three, to me, John, it's about what do your stars do? Your first two games, somebody may be able to steal you a game in a different way, because you're still feeling each other out. You're doing something that I haven't done in a long time. You're courting, right? That's the courting process, the first couple of games of a playoff series. And then you're in a full dance after that. Can you boogie? Can you do a two-step? That's the most I can do, is a two-step, right? I can't do nothing more than a two-step, John. I'm afraid if I ever get married, baby, we going to take some dance lessons. We are going to take some legit dance lessons, because all I got is the two-step. But what can you do after game three of a playoff series? Do you have that rising boat that lifts all tides? If that's Jason Tatum, that's where Jason Tatum shows up. Remember, they collapsed after game three of the NBA Finals against Boston, against the Golden State Warriors, because they did not have another counterpunch. And Stephen Curry had the counterpunch. Not only did he have the counterpunch, he had the big spade, little spade, big counterpunch, all that stuff. And Boston didn't have any answers. Now, let's see if they've learned from that. Let's see if the net rating and all these things hold up. Let's see if everything that we're seeing in the regular season, the hellacious defense, the shot making, the versatility, the ability to score with Porzingis, and Jason Tatum recognizing that he doesn't have to force his game all the time. Let's see if that holds up during the playoffs. I'm very curious, because in the end, we may look at it and say, why were we fooling ourselves? The Celtics have been showing us exactly who they were the entire year. They had the heartbreaks from years past. They had the star power up top. They had the versatility in terms of players and height and switchability, which is a must in today's game. Maybe come June, we are going to be in the Boston Garden and confetti's going to be coming down or whatever it is. And we're going to be saying, why didn't we pick this team? Or there's going to be confetti coming down the Boston Garden and a fat man is going to be holding up the trophy again. And we're going to be saying, why did we ever fool ourselves into thinking that anybody else was going to beat him? And we're back on The Good Word. Producer John and myself, of course, guys, we have the viewing guide for this weekend. John has a couple of games. I have a game that we consider to be quite compelling for the rest of the week. Producer John, what you got?
Well, I got two games. I got one game tonight, which we kind of talked about earlier, which is just trying to wash the bad taste out of my mouth from Max Strus hitting like five threes in the last 3 minutes of that game against the Mavericks and stealing one with a 60-foot shot at the buzzer.
Cue Jason Jackson. The Strus is loose.
They play in Toronto tonight against a Raptors team that has won three straight.
Yep.
That is starting to find its identity.
Mm-hmm.
That, quite honestly, has a lot of good players. And that, you know, kind of the result of them trading away OG Anunoby and Pascal Siakam was they got draft capital, but they got a lot of good players. And they've had a few weeks now. They've had the All-Star break. They're really starting to mesh well. RJ Barrett is, I think, back from an injury. They've won three in a row. I don't know if you saw the whole thing about they got a pizza party for winning three in a row.
I did see that.
Good for them. And the Mavericks, who previously were riding a 7-game winning streak, now have a 2-game losing streak. So I was telling you before we started recording that the game against the Cavs last night was interesting because you could see the Mavericks wanted to get back into their winning momentum, and the Cavs already have all this winning momentum that they were desperate to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's similar feelings going into this Toronto game. Dallas, like, we have to turn this around. The Raptors are not in our league, right? The Cavs are number two in the East, but the Raptors are like 10th, 11th. They're 14 games under 500 or whatever it is. this should be a game where the Mavericks can just beat up on the Raptors and get right, but it's not the Wizards. It's not the Pistons. It's not even the Spurs. It's a team that's starting to find themselves. It's going to be dangerous for the Mavericks. So I'm going to be watching that. And then tomorrow night, I'm assuming this game's on TNT, although I didn't look it up. The rematch of last year's NBA Finals.
Mm.
The aforementioned Denver Nuggets with the guy that we refer to as the Fat Man, a.k.a. the greatest basketball player in the world at the moment. And the Miami Heat, who I don't tweet anymore, Vinny, because I don't want to help that man. But the other day when I saw what the Heat were going into that game against Sacramento with, or rather without, all of their suspended players and injured players, and I think even the Ball Don't Lie Twitter account sent out something showing that they were only going to have like six guys and they're mostly mm-hmm. bench players. I almost retweeted that with, guaranteed Spo win. Like, nobody loves that exact situation more than Eric Spoelstra. And of course, they pulled off the win against the Sacramento Kings, who are not a bad team. They're going to be a playoff team. And the Heat are starting to look like the Heat again. Terry Rozier has like not even existed for them. And it doesn't matter. They just look like the Heat again. They're tougher than you. They play harder than you. They're smarter than you. And they look like that team again. It kind of looks like they coasted to the All-Star break. Maybe they did. Maybe they're like, hey, championship hangover, all this stuff. We need to coast until we get to the All-Star break, and then we'll do the 100% Heat culture thing. But they're doing the 100% Heat culture thing, and the Nuggets are a very good measuring stick. These are two teams that I don't even think there was like bad blood in the finals last year, but they really like to beat one another because there's a lot of respect as far as how good each other's team is. So I'm going to be watching that. I want to see how the Heat look. I want to see how the Nuggets look. I want to see how that matchup looks, because if that ends up being the finals again, I'm not going to be that surprised.
Yeah, I think especially after doing all this stuff that we've been talking about with the Boston Celtics and how great the net rating is and everything else. And you know what I think about? Even going back to that a little bit, a team that's on the list a little further down from the Boston Celtics, I think maybe four or five spots from the Celtics down. The 2012-13 Oklahoma City Thunder. And you know what happened to them? Russell Westbrook got hurt in the first round, I believe, against the Rockets. That's when Patrick Beverley ran into his knee during that timeout. And that team looked so poised and so ready after losing in the finals. And they were going to come back and they were going to do it. And what happened? Russell Westbrook got hurt. They advanced past Houston in that round, but they were no match for the Memphis Grizzlies, I believe, in the second round. I believe that's what it was. They lost in five. I think they won game one, lost the next four games, because it was just Kevin Durant and nobody else. So when I think of the Heat, not that I think of them in the same vein as the Thunder, because, you know, just top-level talent, but losing in the finals and trying to get back. And Miami is finding, like John just eloquently said, finding its rhythm. They're not a fifth in the East. They won five straight games. They are past Philly, who everybody expected to fall, which, you know, without Joel Embiid out there, past Orlando, past Indiana. They're not fifth, and they're slated for a first-round grudge match against the New York Knicks. But the New York Knicks have more players in the infirmary, thanks to Tibbs, than they do out on the floor. So while the Heat are getting healthier, you got questions about Milwaukee. You got questions about the Knicks. Don't really have questions about the Cavs right now from a regular season standpoint. How high can the Heat go? How high do they want to go? And the other question is, how high do the Boston Celtics not want them to go? Because if there's one team that the Boston Celtics is looking at and saying, hey, man, do we have to face them this year? Can they just go away? Can someone else knock them off before they get to us? It's probably the Miami Heat. Right? Eric Spoelstra. Remember I said, two coaches in the league that I would take above anybody else, Eric Spoelstra and Ty Lue. They can take theirs and beat yours and take yours and beat theirs. I think that's a Bum Phillips line that I got that. Bum Phillips, old football coach, that I got that from. And the game for me is the same Boston Celtics on Sunday. It's a Sunday showcase game on I think it's on ABC because it's a Sunday afternoon game. Warriors and Celtics. And I'm not sure how good the Golden State Warriors are. And I know that Chris Paul just came back. We mentioned that at the top of the show. But this is a different Chris Paul. This is a different Warriors team than the one that Chris Paul exited on January 5th when he left with the hand injury. Klay Thompson was starting. Draymond Green wasn't there. Andrew Wiggins was coming off the bench then. Now you have Klay Thompson on the bench. Wiggins back in the starting lineup. Draymond is back. Pods is getting all the burn. What does that put Chris Paul? What does that put Steve Kerr? It's a coaching job, like we said earlier, or like we said Monday, rather, with Sam Amick. There's a lot of Rubik's Cube pieces that you're going to have to fit together. And you're putting yourself against a Celtics team that feels like they know exactly who they are. And then you just add the element of Jrue Holiday. And this is still a team that looks at the Warriors as kind of like their bullies, kind of like the guys that they need to measure themselves up against, because that those finals still ring out, right? Those finals still very much ring out. So those are the games to watch this week for the rest of the week. And that is all we have for you on today's episode of The Good Word. Thanks to producer John for showing us some of his Dallas Mavericks vulnerability, and also for everything else that he does and the entire team who works hard behind the scenes on this show. Jake and Dan will be back tomorrow for another episode of No Cap Room. And I will be back on Monday for another episode of The Good Word. Until then, everybody be safe.